Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. Today is the 18th of June 2014 and I am delighted once again to be able to invite our very good friend Dr. Tim Ball back to the programme, who joins us now for a fourth time. And if you haven't heard his other interviews with us, I do suggest that you go back through the audio archive at The Mind Renewed and check those out, because Dr. Ball is always very, very interesting and informative and also entertaining, which is a perfect combination that always makes for a fantastic conversation. So Dr. Ball, of course, is a retired professor of climatology at the University of Winnipeg, where he taught for 25 years. And he's an environmentalist, a public speaker, consultant, author and columnist. Dr. Ball, it's great to be speaking to you again. Thanks very much for coming on.
Well, thank you for those kind comments. You've raised the bar pretty high.
No, you raised the bar yourself. That's why I made the comment.
self-inflicted wounds, yes.
Well, we've talked about so many things already and on the various interviews that we've had so far. And the subject we're going to be talking about today, which actually is connected, I think, to some of the things that you've spoken about on this program before, is the subject of peer review, especially in academia, both in publishing and in funding as well. And this is the practice which, although it has actually existed in some form or other for quite some time, for centuries, it really only got going as a standard way of proceeding. And this was a surprise to me, actually, when I found this out, as late as the middle of the 20th century. And it's a practice whereby editors of journals or funding bodies will invite experts, usually university academics, to review articles that come in for publication or research proposals that come in for funding, to check that this material is up to snuff, to use a rather old-fashioned expression, and as the buzzwords would have it, to check the validity, the significance and the originality of this submitted material. We could call it quality control, I guess. Well, that's the idea anyway, and that all sounds very reasonable on the surface, very convincing, but of course there are many problems and pitfalls associated with this in actual practice, and of course that's going to be what we're going to be getting on to as we go through the interview today. So could I start, Dr. Ball, by asking you to give us a fuller idea of what peer review is, or let me put that differently, of what peer review is supposed to be, how it's supposed to work. Describe to us the nuts and bolts of the ideal peer review process.
Yes, it's sort of like the difference of how you hit the golf ball on the practice range. And then, as Ken Venturi said, there's that long walk to the first tee and something changes in there. Of course, the idea of peer review parallels what goes on in the courtroom where you're judged by your peers. But notice how they've distorted that. Now the juries are selected. Instead of the original idea of just going out and grabbing 12 people off the street and say, okay, you're going to make a judgment, now we've got all these specialists and experts manipulating and saying, oh, we know better. Peer review was the idea that if you were going to publish an article, it should be viewed by fellow or peer experts, and they would advise an editor on whether to publish or not. It is such a system that is so open to abuse, subjectivity, and of course that's what's happened with it. I think that it's of no value anymore, but that's where we really want to end.
From what I've experienced of peer review, it seems to be that most of the people who are reviewers, who are actually invited to review, as you say, they are experts in their field, but it's normally done in this kind of single blind situation where the author will actually not know who the reviewers are. But there is a double blind situation, I understand, where the identities of all the people concerned in this are actually masked. Do you have anything to say about those two different processes, whether one is better than the other?
No, I don't think any of them are any good. I mean, if you think about it, and we go back to the legal system, if you have a right to face your accuser, and in peer review, what's happening is somebody anonymously can reject your article or not have it published, which can have great implication for your career. For somebody to have that power and not be accountable is simply wrong from the legal and philosophical point of view. So, as I said, I think that's one of the fundamental problems. If you don't like an article, then you should have the courage to face the people that you're saying it to. If not, then shut up. It's that simple.
Well, I'm assuming that there must be some positive things to say about it, at least in principle. So let's just, you know, pretend for a moment anyway, based on what you've already said to me, that there are some pros and cons, so to speak, about the PR. Oh, there we go. You said I'd call it public relations. The PR, right. The peer review process. So I want to start with the possibility that there might be some positive things about it. So can you think of anything that, in your opinion, is positive about peer review and the way it actually works in the real world?
No. Completely. Let me elaborate on that, though. That's a very terse answer. So the reason I say no is because, and this is going to sound like a sort of a great leap, but, you know, there is fault in everything, and there is good in everything, and we make decisions. And it's the old cost-benefit approach, right? There are benefits to things and there are costs to things. You weigh these up and you decide if the benefits outweigh the cost, you go ahead with it. The reason I say no with peer review is because I think that the costs outweigh the benefits. I do the same thing, and I used to talk to my students about this with people. You have to make judgments about people. You say, well, okay, that person's got a lot of good qualities, but there are certain bad qualities that cancel all the good ones. I mean, I'll give you an example of the Canadian hockey player, Bobby Hull. And he would stay at the rink and he would sign autographs and he opposed fighting on the ice and all of these things. And he seemed like a great gentleman and everybody adored him, but he went home and beat his wife. Well, sorry, Bobby, that cancels all the other stuff you're doing. Well, I think that that's true of anything, and I think it's true of the peer review. To me, the costs far outweigh the benefits.
Okay, so fair enough. You've made your point there. And what I'm going to do now is I'm going to put to you some arguments that are put in favor of the peer review process. And I take what you've said. You don't feel, you've already told me, you don't feel that those are going to be of sufficient weight to change your mind on this. But let's just explore those for a few minutes and see what you actually think of those particular points. It is brought up that peer review helps the public, because it gives people confidence that when they're reading articles, they're reading quality material. Because, you know, we live in a world where we're faced with this bewildering mass of claims in the media about all kinds of things, you know, from alternative medicine and wonder diets to, you know, unorthodox theories about life, the universe and everything, whatever. So doesn't it help people to know that experts have sorted out the wheat from the chaff, so to speak, and they're reading quality material?
No, because they don't know who's judged the material. Right. That's the anonymous part. And not only that, but the public don't read academic journals. They don't read peer review material. And it's one of the things that's gone on with the peer review is that some of the journalists started going through some of the journals, but picking out headlines or the title of the article that was sensationalist towards climate change, for example. And so. No, it doesn't help the public at all. And of course, now we've had this scandal in the climate science area of the misuse of peer review. That, to me, cancels all of the positive benefits of giving confidence to the reader.
Okay, so does it help academics then? You say the normal person in the street, as it were, doesn't read these academic papers, but the academics do, and they're presented with thousands and thousands of articles, and they can't possibly read through everything, so they buy what they consider to be the best journals, they've been peer-reviewed, and so they can then look at they believe to be the best research. Well, isn't that helpful to sift out all those hundreds of thousands of papers and reduce it to a more manageable group?
Well, I mean, people do that anyway, but you see, one of the problems, and we're going to talk about this a bit later on, I think, science and academia has become so specialized that very few people read a range of journals. Mm. I discovered this many, many years ago when in one particular general area, there were something like 520 journals published every year. You couldn't read one a day and keep up with it. And the articles have become so specialized that the number of people that are going to read them already know. I'll give you a good example from another perspective. Scientific American was a journal that was on the newsstands. It was effectively trying to take science into the trade area, as they say. So there's a difference between an academic publication and a trade publication. And Scientific American wrote articles about very specialized science areas. But if you knew the article and the subject matter, you knew that it was a gross oversimplification of the actual subject. But did that help the public? Probably not. Most of them didn't understand. What Scientific American did in order to get around that problem was that they started becoming more sensational. They started publishing things about climate change, and, oh, you know, it's the end of the world, and they went more sensationalist, not because they wanted to inform better, but because they wanted to sell more journals. And that's what's been going on in the academic world.
I have to say, I've noticed that with the New Scientist as well. Yep. Every time you go past the magazine rack, you see, you know, the latest new hyper theory about the universe. It seems implausible to me just looking at the cover, but there it is. But it's very sensational. Yeah.
And well, that's where the PR of public relations becomes the PR of peer review. And of course, that's what's going on. Many people don't know that in the old days, and I remember having to do this, paying a journal to publish an article for me. That was quite common when I started out. Wow. And the reason was, of course, because of the cost of publishing the journal. What happened was that large publishing houses bought out a lot of these academic journals. And of course, they then put the emphasis upon selling the journals. Now, they make their money. For example, I, as a retired researcher, I can't afford to subscribe to Nature. Go and look at the cost of a subscription. But all of that is paid for by academics who get their universities to buy it for them. And so what you've got is research funding private publishing companies who are then going to publish sensational articles in order to sell more journals. It's become corrupted beyond the peer review issue because of the funding and who runs the journals.
So I suppose in a way that kind of collapses my next question, because I was going to ask you, does it help editors? You know, they've got to make a decision as to what gets published. Well, doesn't peer review help them to choose between the good and the bad?
Well, but that leads to what I call peer review censorship. You see, an editor is going to get the article and look at it and say, well, who will I get to review this? Well, they then go to the high priests of the prevailing wisdom, who are then going to say, yes, it's a good article, or no, this is heresy, don't publish, which then makes it censorship rather than proper peer review. I can tell you, I found one benefit to peer review. I used the system. I used to send articles to journals, and then when I got the reviewers' comments, I rewrite the article. In other words, I got them to do my editing for me. And then and then I would send the article back, having made all the corrections that the peer reviewer said. Well, they couldn't reject it then.
You're playing their game, yes.
Exactly. But that's the point, that it is a game. And and of course, what you do is you hire editors that are going to produce the kind of journal and the kind of emphasis you want. I urge you people to go and look at Donna LaFrambois' article. And she wrote the book, The Delinquent Teenager, which was about all of the corruption of the IPCC. I don't think it's any coincidence that the editors of the Journal of Climatology were major IPCC people. So Andrew Weaver, the computer guy, Michael Mann, and you go down the list. They effectively took over that journal as editors in order to publish the things that they wanted published. That's the degree of corruption that goes on with this sort of thing.
Okay, well, we're going to return to a number of those points, actually, that you brought up there, because, I mean, those are the three main things that I wanted to ask you about. Is peer review actually useful? And in each one of those, no, it doesn't seem, as far as you're concerned anyway, it doesn't seem that it presents a very good case there. So I'm going to turn now to the cons, and I've got a whole list of things here, and I may actually come back to you as a kind of devil's advocate with, by the way, that's my cat in the background making a noise, you know, as I come back on each one of these. But I want to turn then, first of all, to this question of anonymity. Surely there is something to be said for this. If all the reviewers were completely known, wouldn't that cause problems? Wouldn't there therefore, you know, be suspicions and recriminations? Doesn't it avoid that kind of thing?
By the way, I hope the cat's comments were positive from the peer review point of view, but or is that the per review?
Oh, very good, very good. I think she's just annoyed that she's not being attended to. That's all. Okay. It is.
And of course, that's the academic ego too. the answer is that it's a very negative thing. Of course, we can go back to the very fundamental comment from the Bible that the devil's work is done in the darkness. Peer review and anonymity, it was almost necessary to prevent a hostility amongst academics because of the specialization. I mean, I know that in my areas, I didn't have to know who wrote the article. I knew who wrote the article by the topic and by the style and by the emphasis. You knew all the people that were publishing. And if you go and look at the Wegman report, the Wegman committee report, now Wegman was appointed by a U.S. Senate or congressional hearing to investigate the hockey stick and to make a judgment on it. And one of the things they identified were the 42 paleoclimate scientists that were all working together. They were writing and they were deciding who would be the authors on different articles, even if they hadn't contributed, because they wanted to pad their CVs. They were all reviewing each other's work. So here was only 42 people in one very specialized area. And I can tell you, it wasn't just in the publication area. It was in the funding area, because when government give out funding, they set up committees to assess which research project should get funding. Well, that was supposedly done anonymously. But again, you knew who the people were. So if you got onto one of those funding committees, well, you could make sure your buddies got funded and the people you didn't like didn't get any funding. And there was a lot of that going on as well. So in terms of anonymity, absolutely not. If academics are so hypersensitive that they can't separate criticism of their work from criticism of themselves, then they better sort that problem out. But you don't do it with anonymity.
And do you think that anonymity actually encourages these cliques to form, because people just don't know, you know, who's actually behind what's going on, and so any kind of associations can form?
That was precisely what was going on with the people at the Climatic Research Unit and the anonymity there. Yeah, they used that. And in fact, they deliberately chose the peer review process to attack other people, saying, oh, you're not peer reviewed. It was said about me just yesterday. It's simply not true, but they were the ones that made peer review a big issue, because what happened was the skeptics found a journal that would publish their stuff, and Michael Mann said, oh, no, you know, they're playing our game. He actually said in one of the leaked emails, this was the danger of always criticizing the skeptics for not publishing in the peer-reviewed literature. Okay, well, they played our game. They've gone and found a journal that they can control the peer review process and publish what they want. So he was admitting what they were doing in that leaked email. So, yeah, it is far too open for abuse, but primarily because of specialization, so few people in the world that are in a particular area that it was very easy to take control.
And do you think that business of specialization has other dangers as well, in that if people are reviewing material that's coming in for publication or for funding, because of their narrow specialization, they may not actually spot things. They may not observe problems in the article that they would if they had a slightly broader view of the world. Do you think that's a problem as well?
Oh, totally. I mean, the discovery of the hockey stick, which was supposedly peer-reviewed, but of course it was peer-reviewed by Michael Mann and his buddies. So it was another of those phony peer reviews, but it was exposed because Stephen McIntyre, a statistician, was at a conference on statistics, and somebody put this graph up. Well, he didn't know that it was climate. He didn't know anything about it. But the minute he saw it, because of his expertise in graphing of statistical data, he knew what was wrong with it, and he knew how it was achieved. So, yeah, that's the problem. It's a difficulty that I've always dealt with as a climatologist, because as a climatologist, I'm a generalist. And I knew right from the very start that I was going to be dealing with specialized areas. So, for example, I knew that climate was about averages and data and statistics. So I took a couple of university level stats courses, not because I wanted to be a statistician, but because I knew if I wanted to deal with statistics, I had to go and talk to a statistician, tell them what I wanted, but then also understand what they were telling me. But what's happened with specialization is that not only do people not talk to each other, but they also use data and methods from other areas that they don't understand and they use incorrectly. That, again, was one of the recommendations of the Wegman report, where they said that these paleoclimatologists were simply not talking to the stats community and that they should be. So, yeah, it's a serious problem. And I've always described this with climate. It's like a 10,000-piece puzzle, and everybody's got a piece of the puzzle, all the specialists, but they've lost the box top. The other analogy that I use to get the public to understand the problem is that you've got a patient lying on the table, and the podiatrist is looking at the feet, the nephrologist is looking at the kidneys, and the neurosurgeon's looking at the brain, but the nurse is in the corner saying, but doctors, the patient's dead.
Right. Yes.
That's exactly the kind. And by the way, that's what the problem you notice with medicine. You go to the general practitioner. They narrow the list and then they send you to the specialists. Okay. The reason that the Mayo Clinic is successful is because you go to the Mayo Clinic, you're there for 2 weeks, all of the specialists see you, but then before you leave, all of the specialists sit together with the patient and pool all of their specialist results, out of which they reach a general conclusion. That's not happening in most of science today.
Mm-hmm. Aren't you, in a sense, arguing for a broader peer review process so that you would, you know, in the case of the hockey stick graph, for example, you know, you'd have your dendrochronologist, you'd have all sorts of representation, you'd have your statistician in there as well. You'd make sure that every branch that was appropriate to the study would be included in the peer review process. And if that was done, wouldn't it therefore work?
Ideally, yes. But here's the problem. When you publish an article, you very rarely list books. Because, now that will change a little bit, but because historically, from the time the person started writing the book to the time it got published was 2 to 3 years, and the material was out of date. Articles, of course, ostensibly were one part of the book, but could get published much more quickly. But now, if you look at the top of articles, academic articles, they list the date that it was submitted and the date that it was published. All right, there's quite a gap in there, because one of the things that peer reviewers are notorious for, and academics generally, is they don't work to any timetable. One of the great frustrations of being an editor is getting people to respond and get the stuff in on time. And that's also, by the way, is another part of what's wrong with the peer review process, because editors tend to go with people that they know will get the job done very quickly. But that's no measure of quality. And so if you start sending it out for peer review to more academics, you're going to end up with 2-3 years between the time the article is submitted and the time it's published. And so that doesn't work either.
Okay, well, what about the problem of what I'm calling detachment? So, okay, I'm imagining a reviewer sitting there in their armchair and they've got this bunch of articles that they're looking at, and they're not going to go and work with the raw data. They're not going to re-crunch the computer codes or go through the calculations again. So I'm assuming the chances are they're going to let some of the errors go through because they're just not going to go back to the raw data. Is that a big problem, do you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And, of course, this was part of what Steve McIntyre with the hockey stick thing was pushing, that you've got to disclose computer codes, which, of course, are the instructions you give to the computer for your computer model. And if you don't know those, then you can't reconstruct what they've done. That's why, even though the emails were leaked from CRU, the person also leaked the computer codes in the Read Me Harry text. Okay, and it's in those computer codes where the words hide the decline. They're telling the computer, well, if this happens, you know, this is the action that you take. And it's the failure to disclose the data and disclose the method. I mean, everybody knows the old, when you wrote a math exam, what were the instructions? Show your work.
Absolutely.
Show your work, right?
Yes.
Well, why was that there? It was there because, you could just stumble on the answer by chance, or you could have got it from your neighbor's paper. And, of course, they wanted to know that you understood and that this was your work. Well, that's what's wrong when people peer review and they're not showing their work. It's all part of the same problem.
And that did actually make me quite suspicious when I was hearing about that sort of thing at the time. And I was Phil Jones went before a parliamentary committee, and so I think he said something along the lines of, we didn't want to release this information because he thought that it might be misused.
Well, that was the quote. A guy by the name of Warwick Hughes, an Australian climatologist, after Jones had come out with the blade of the hockey stick. Okay, so the hockey stick, the handle is virtually no temperature change for 1,000 years, and then suddenly this huge upturn in the 20th century. That blade was produced by Phil Jones. Now, scientifically, tacking on instrumental data onto tree ring data is a no-no. You just don't do that, but they did it anyway. That was one of the problems. But this sudden upturn in temperature, Jones claimed that there was a 0.6 degree Celsius rise in temperature in the last 120 years. But what people didn't notice was it was 0.6 plus or minus 0.2. In other words, it was a number in which there was a plus or minus 33% error. Now, that should never have been published. And so what Warwick Hughes did was he sent an email to Phil Jones saying, you know, I'd like to see your data. And Phil Jones wrote back and said, why should I send my data to you when we've spent 25 years working on this and all you want to do is find fault with it?
That's the one. Yes, indeed.
That's the one. And now Jones was asked at a meeting, at a conference by von Storch, say, you know, did you send this email? Yeah. Phil Jones stood by it. And by the way, if Jones was saying, I hope they don't discover about freedom of information, because otherwise they'll be asking me for this data. And he's telling his colleagues how there's ways to avoid freedom of information. That is, you deposit the data with the university and they don't have to disclose it. But in the final ending of it, Jones lost the data. The dog ate his homework, right?
Yes.
And that... So, you know, I mean, it's really corruption at every single level.
Mm-hmm. And coming back to this issue of specialization, there's something that's related to that, and that is that reviewers, obviously, they tend to be conventionally qualified. They've gone through established institutions, and they've got their PhDs in certain ways of looking at things. So they'll have a certain way of looking at the world. They'll have a certain way of approaching a subject. And doesn't that in itself lead to a narrowness which can clamp down on new ideas?
Well, exactly. And that was what I talked about earlier when the editor is picking out the high priests of the prevailing wisdom. Mm. But of course, it also speaks to the issue that education isn't education anymore. It's indoctrination. Mm. That's why very, very few new ideas are coming out of the academic world. It's become more dogmatic than anything that it's ever criticized, that most new ideas are coming out of industry, out of people's basements, and so on. And you get journals and magazines like The New Yorker and other things like this, The Spectator. This is where ideas are being fomented. It's not occurring in the academic world at all because of this incestuousness. And that's what the peer review system is. It's a purely incestuous situation. And of course, you don't get your PhD until a review by your committee of peers has said, yeah, you're towing the party line, and therefore we'll let you become a PhD and go out and perpetuate the mythology. So the system is negative in every aspect.
Well, I did actually experience a very small example of that kind of thing when I was studying music as an undergraduate, actually, and I was part of my course was to do composition, and there was a friend of mine who was obviously doing composition as well, and he wasn't towing the line. He wasn't doing that sort of avant-garde scene and composing in the style of people like Boulez and Messiaen and this sort of thing, and he decided to go for Frank Zappa as a style, and it didn't suit the academics. And they said, well, no, you can't compose using, you know, electric guitar and all these things out of the pop scene and mix it with the classical. It just doesn't work. From the point of view of our course, it's not going to work. And, you know, at the time, I thought this fellow student had a point, actually, because he could demonstrate compositional skills just as well through the, you know, aping the style of Frank Zappa as he could through aping the style of Pierre Boulez. But it just didn't fit with the culture of the university at the time. I think things have changed, actually, since then. But nevertheless, at the time, he wasn't allowed to do it. He left the course and he went and studied mathematics instead at a different college. Yeah. You know, so that was the effect that it had on him.
Yeah.
And that's just a very small example of a wider problem.
Well, and of course, it's really time that we reduce the number of universities dramatically. I would shut down half of them tomorrow. The idea that every child that goes into kindergarten is going to end up in university by default makes them those that don't failures. And as you know, most of the successful people in the world have simply not gone to university. They haven't been indoctrinated, and therefore they're free thinking.
Well, I was just going to say, I think we've got to point out the irony of this, that both you and I have been through the education system, and so I think people need to turn this podcast off now.
Well, yeah, but here's the point. I was seen as a rebel within the university. I was seen as somebody that was trying to destroy the system. You know, for example, he's a good teacher. Well, that means he's an entertainer, right? And I used to say, well, yeah, if the students are not coming to my class or are sleeping, what's the point, right? But this is the kind of narrowness that these people who control the system. But I just wanted to comment about the specialization. Here's the difficulty that has evolved. The last universal person, now people know about Renaissance people, that is people that have a fairly wide range of knowledge. People like a Jonathan Miller in the UK, you know, Peter Ustinov is another example. Very erudite, very widely read and interesting to listen to. But the universal person was a person who knew all of the knowledge that was known at the time. Now, in science, that person was Alexander von Humboldt, after who the Humboldt current was named. He was the first person to start drawing weather maps. He had visited every continent. He knew all the physics, all the chemistry, all the biology that was known at the time. He died in 1859. And from that year on, the proliferation of data was so great that it forced people into specialized areas. And it's still not fully understood. I mean, I would say to students, well, what are you going to specialize in? And say, well, I'm going to go into medicine. I said, no, that's not a speciality. Red blood cells, that's a speciality, right?
Mosquito anatomy, as I heard once, and I was astonished. I think somebody was given a doctor of science for mosquito anatomy, and I thought, wow, how could anybody have spent their whole life looking at the little bits of a mosquito? But there we are.
Yeah, but they can go out and put the bite on somebody. See, that's the whole point. but the point about this is, of course, the challenge. How do you cope with all of this data and yet still see the pattern? It truly is an example of you can't see the forest for the trees. Now, the computer helped to some extent because the computer can handle enormous amounts of data. It's like the internet. The internet was the final stage in democracy because now information, which had been controlled by a very few people, was now accessible to everybody. But the problem with it is you can get stuff off the internet and data, yeah, to the ends of the earth. But if you don't understand it and you can't analyze it and you can't put it in context, it's meaningless. The side of the whole intellectual debate that we've virtually abandoned is teaching people how to discriminate. The ability to discriminate and understand data and to put it in a context, it is absolutely essential as the amount of data increases. And yet we're not doing that. And that's where the error lies.
And of course, I suppose that's where somebody who would be an apologist for peer review would say that's exactly what peer review does. It helps to sift so that people, you know, can trust this body of experts who have sifted all this information so they know that they're looking at quality now. But you're saying, no, that's not working.
It's not working because you've got one specialist who's only looked at one area looking at one paper that was written by other specialists in the same area.
Yeah. So this problem of specialism that's just proliferated, as you say, is actually being magnified by this peer review process, not helped.
Yes. And by the way, you see it not just in the academic world, but in society. To generalize is unacceptable. You can't generalize. And the dictum that developed in academic world was to generalize is the mark of a fool. To specialize is the mark of genius. Now, to give you an example, and your friend in the music thing became a part of this, you see the arrogance of people that have mathematical skills and the physicists who talk about hard sciences as opposed to the soft sciences of the social sciences. This is all part of that same debate that only certain people know and understand. Only certain people can crunch numbers. Well, yeah, I'm sorry, but, you know, and oh, by the way, where you see that summarized in society is the phrase, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. When people say that, what does it mean? If you think about it, what they're saying is somehow a rocket scientist is superior to the rest of us. Well, sorry, I don't think so. Substitute another person in society for a rocket scientist. Say, well, you don't have to be a farmer. Well, people start laughing.
I agree with you. This does annoy me. And particularly, there's a kind of a trend at the moment for certain kind of scientistic types. I would say scientists, you know, people with a kind of scientific philosophy. They'll say philosophy is useless. That is such a self-contradictory way of looking at things because, of course, you know, having a view of science where nothing else matters but the scientific method itself is a way of proceeding that can't be shown by some sort of scientific experiment to be valid. It's a philosophical position. So to say philosophy is useless is just a circular reasoning. But it comes, as you say, from this kind of attitude of saying a certain way of looking at the world is superior and everything else is useless.
Yeah. Exactly. Where you see that, many people don't know this, but at many universities, if you take a math major, you get an arts degree, not a science degree. Math is an art.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And on that circular spectrum of disciplines and specializations, math is right next to philosophy. Because if you take philosophy, what do? You take logic courses. And what is math but pure logic? Then, as you know, in the old English system, you had pure and applied mathematics. That was recognizing that the pure was the theoretical, the applied was the real world. And, of course, that's also what we're talking about with any system that we have, whether it's peer review. Between the theory and the application, there's a huge gap that if you don't recognize, you're going to fall into. That's really a part of the problem as well.
Would you say, I'm trying to sort of bring these things together in my mind from what you said, would you say that peer review is structurally open to abuse by its very nature? I mean, even if it was functioning at one point perfectly well, because you have this, you know, the insertion of a middle person, perhaps with anonymity, with all these things that you've been talking about, do you think that sometime along the line it's bound to be abused just because of the structure of it?
Yes, because the more complex you make a structure, the more likely that it will fail. And then the idea of adding anonymity to that, where people are then not held accountable for their failures, and where one person can have the control over what comes in, what is dealt with, and what goes out. And that person is chosen in order to perpetuate whoever's funding the thing or whatever the objective of the thing is. I mean, that creates so many.
Yeah, that's actually another issue that I wanted to ask you about, to say a little bit more about how finance can actually cause pressure in this situation. Because, I mean, I'm just thinking of someone, say, who's working in a particular area that's, funded by the pharmaceutical industry, something like that. I would have thought they're not likely to champion the causes of people who are going to be critical of that industry. But the result of that, I would have thought, they get more funding, they get more prestige, they have greater and greater say, actually, in that peer review process itself. And so, I mean, I'm just imagining here that money could end up controlling the peer review process very easily.
Oh, well, it does, as I mentioned earlier. But even worse is government funding. Oh, well, no, government wouldn't direct funding. Well, that has increased or changed dramatically. It's changed to the point where most governments now try to do research funding through a secondary arm's length from government agency. But the bureaucrats that control that, now these are the faceless, unaccountable people that determine where the funding goes. And of course, if they've come out of university indoctrinated into a certain way of looking at things, they're going to fund some projects and not others. But one of the big things that affected academia, particularly in the Western world, was it used to be publish or perish. But then in the 70s and 80s, as government started to cut back and we had the financial crashes and so on, government started to reduce, they started cutting funding to universities. But the universities discovered that they could simply tack on a 35% or so charge onto the funding that a faculty member received. Perfectly reasonable, because they could say, well, look, we're providing you with space and heat and light and all the support facilities. Somebody's got to pay for that. We're not getting enough money from the government. Of course, what did that do? That inflated the amount of funding that a researcher needed, but it also inflated the value of that faculty member to the university. And I can give you several stories of people that were doing completely phony research, but were protected by the university because they were bringing in large amounts of money. I mean, you've only got to look at the University of East Anglia and Phil Jones that we were talking about earlier. He was getting something like $20 million a year. Well, of course the university are going to protect him, as they did. And they set up phony committees to investigate. And the same thing happened at Penn State, because Michael Mann was also bringing in millions of research funding. So it's up and down the whole system. And nobody's surprised by this. I mean, you can get very cynical, like the American commentator who's always said, if you want the answers, follow the money.
In fact, what you were just saying then, I think, neatly fits with my next question. I apologize for being sort of conspiratorially minded, but this is the kind of thing that goes on in the world. So I wanted to ask you if you think that the growth of peer review in the 20th century is partly the result of a deliberate policy, let's say by social engineers, perhaps functioning in the academic world or around the academic world, and corporations with, of course, their shareholders to pay, and that this is ensuring that voices that might challenge these centers of power don't get much of a hearing. Do you think there's a case for saying some of this is deliberate?
It's a difficult thing to prove. Based upon my knowledge of human nature, yes, it's probably true. But as I said, it's very difficult to prove. What happens more often is every idea, everything that's invented or produced has a good and a bad side to it. And of course, unfortunately, there are people that will find the bad use of things. So it's having to be constantly aware of that. Everything starts with an idea, whether it's an invention or a country or a company. But then the idea needs a structure to disseminate it and produce it and market it and all the rest of it. What happens is the structure becomes more important than the idea. So at a certain point, what has to happen but doesn't normally happen is you've got to sit down as a group or as an individual and say, okay, this is where the idea started. How far have we drifted from that original idea? Is the drift acceptable, or is it taking us in the wrong direction? And if so, then we go back to the original idea. The classic example of this, of course, is in history, where you got Christianity as an idea, and then the church is formed. And by the time Luther comes around, the church is more important than the idea. And so once you understand the dynamics of how society functions, how people function, then you can start identifying and determining whether you want to deal with it or not. And this problem of drift, of abuse, using things for evil is very fundamentally a part of human nature, and yet we really don't have systems to accommodate it.
Yes, towards the end, actually, I'm going to mention there is a feeling within many circles that peer review is actually not working very well, and there are various alternatives that are being suggested, so I'll come to that in a few minutes. I wanted to ask you about what I think is perhaps the potentially most damaging aspect to this, and this is where there are matters that are very controversial when an article is produced that clashes perhaps with an ideology, clashes with a worldview. Then peer review can come in as a real weapon in that case. And I want to turn to a comment that was made by the mathematician Dr. David Berlinsky, who's very sympathetic to the intelligent design movement within science, which of course challenges the neo-Darwinian paradigm, and so hardly ever gets published in the mainstream science journals. And he says that the peer review process, he does say that it does work in weeding out some poor material, but he nevertheless says that when a paper touches on something really controversial, especially if it challenges a prevailing paradigm, these are his words, he says that peer review becomes a profoundly treacherous process.
Yep.
Do you think he's right about that? At that point, when it actually clashes with worldview, then that invites the worst kind of reaction to take place.
Yes, because it's narrowing down. It's creating tunnel vision. So many inventions and new ideas come about by that lovely word that has so much importance in science and society, serendipity. That you're looking for one thing, but you stumble across something else. Well, the peer review process would almost guarantee that what you discovered serendipitously was not circulated. So, yeah, I totally agree with him. I think that that's absolutely right. And by the way, this peer review thing, some people historically have tried to get around it. The most famous, in my opinion, was Galileo, because they narrowed what got out, what was published through writing or doing everything in Latin. Well, Galileo published in Italian because Galileo thought that if he could bypass the prevailing wisdom and those that controlled it and go directly to the people of and say, look, here's an idea that I'm putting out there. If the people bought into it, then the authorities were more likely to be forced to accept it. But of course, the difficulty goes to what we talked about earlier, that most of the public don't read, even in Italian, what Galileo was saying and writing.
Yeah.
But it was an early example of what's going on.
Sure. And that Galileo affair is a fascinating subject in its own right. And that would be a great. I would love to have a conversation about that sometime, because I think it's actually very misunderstood in many ways. Actually, it's a very complex issue. I wanted to ask you if you feel that the climate science debacle that's been going on is related actually in some ways to the example I brought up there with Dr. David Belinsky's quote in the idea of a clash of worldview. Do you think that much of the resistance within the climate science establishment actually boils down to a worldview clash, and that they don't want articles from people challenging the CO2 orthodoxy in many cases because it clashes with this worldview they have that it's human beings are the problem, CO2 being produced by human beings is the problem, and it's whatever the status of the science of the article that's coming in, it clashes with that on a worldview level. Do you think there's something to be said for that?
Oh, absolutely. All of that has been corrupted and perverted and misdirected when they chose climate and global warming for a political agenda. That's what distorts the whole process. And the difficulty is those climate scientists that chose the peer review process to pursue a political agenda. That's why I mentioned earlier Laframboise's comment about the Journal of Climate, where she in the article identifies 16 members of the IPCC that were directly connected with that journal. Well, of course, they're going to publish articles to support what they're saying. And of course, people can't believe that a scientist would be other than a pure scientist, that they could have a political agenda. And so you add into that problem of generalist specialist the perversion of politics.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this boils down to the question, do we actually need peer review? Now, you said at the top of the interview, nope, you don't think so. And throughout it, you've been making your case for this. And I'm going to throw in a comment by Andrew Monford. This is in his book, The Hockey Stick Illusion. He observes that peer review didn't really function as the real way of doing things until the middle of the 20th century. And he said that before that, it was journal editors themselves that functioned in this way, really, and they would only occasionally turn to somebody else if they weren't sure whether they should publish something. And so, in a sense, the burden of proof has shifted, and now it's articles have got to sort of prove themselves worthy rather than it being assumed that an article is pretty much worthy unless you can find some problem with it. And so, you know, if editors could do a pretty good job in the past, why not now? Do we even need this extra layer of scrutiny? Can't the editor just do the job?
Well, of course, Andrew Montford's, I think his website moniker is Bishop Hill.
Yes.
And I never disagree with bishops. But no, here's the point. By having anonymous peer reviewers, it takes that editor off the hook. in the old days, the editor made the judgments, and the editors were the top people in their field. But they also had levels of integrity which have disappeared in the 20th century, disappeared because of funding, disappeared because of career advancement, all of the other pressures of society. To be an editor of a journal in the early days was an enormous prestigious position. But by having peer review, you allow the editor to be the person in control, but not being responsible. Because the editor could pick the reviewers they wanted, what I talked about earlier, editor censorship. But then they could say, well, hey, it wasn't me. I just had to do what the reviewers told me. So it takes the editor off the hook as well. So that there's no accountability by anybody anymore. So that's why I agree with what Montfort is saying.
And so would you also agree with this quote that he has? I had to mention this because I think it's such an excellent quote that he brings up in his book. And this is from Richard Smith, who was a former editor of the British Medical Journal. And so this is the quote, and I'm going to ask you if you basically agree with this, because it seems quite an extreme quote. Quote, "We have little evidence of the effectiveness of peer review, but we have considerable evidence of its defects. In addition to being poor at detecting gross defects and almost useless for detecting fraud, it is slow, expensive, profligate of academic time, highly subjective, something of a lottery, prone to bias, and easily abused." Now, that is a completely damning statement there. Is there anything in that statement that you would disagree with?
The only comment I would make is it's an understatement.
Right. Well, I think that says it all. So you have nothing good to say for peer review. Okay, so what's the way forward then, Dr. Ball? Do you think that peer review as we know it today is going to stay? Is it going to become narrower and stronger and therefore do more damage? Do you think that given the many problems that, that you've been listing here today, do you think that it's likely to undergo a radical change? Because there are voices that are calling for this change. Or do you think it's going to give way to something else completely?
I hope it will. I know there's been various attempts, for example, where journals are now putting out an article on the internet and allowing everybody to comment on it.
Yeah.
That's a much more democratic process and, of course, widens the chance that somebody that is in a totally unrelated discipline could look at something and see that it was wrong. That has some merit, and of course it takes advantage of the instant communication and feedback. And one of the things I think that people know is that if you have a blog, you read the articles that are published there, but the commentary is so much more informative often than the article. Because now, instead of one newspaper or one journalist looking at it, you got 2 billion eyes around the world looking at it and commenting on it. So that is part of the democratization of information.
That does seem to be a good way to go. But the trouble is that some of the examples that I've seen of that kind of thing have crowdsourced, as they say, put this up on the internet for people to look at. But then the final arbiter of the decision becomes still the expert. And so I'm just a little bit, this is a cynical eye here, I'm just wondering whether some of this is actually, you know, just giving people a taste of what it could be like, but actually not giving them real power.
Well, yeah, that's true. And of course, you get somebody into a debate or an argument, and at a certain point, they'll just say you're an idiot and walk away. But then in doing that, those experts, by failing to answer the questions, just eliminate themselves effectively. I think that the true marketplace, and of course that's the problem, very, very rarely have we ever had a true free market. In fact, ironically, I think the only true market that I'm aware of was the black market in the Soviet Union under communism. Right? By the way, I saw that operating because the Russian fishing fleets would come into Gibraltar when we were flying out of there, and if they came in, they just bought everything in sight. So it was the free.
I'm sure the dialecticians of the party would love that.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you saying that you think a radically free market approach to this, to publication, would actually be the answer to this problem?
Yes. Let people judge for themselves. One of the things that people are tired of is being told what to think. Hmm. In fact, the talk I gave yesterday, I started out by saying morning. And then I said, notice I didn't say good. Make up your own minds. Who am I to tell you?
That's a good example.
Exactly. Yeah.
But then if you have a free market approach, then this kind of, you know, it's going to be what sells that is going to be the arbiter of truth. And yet often what sells is not what's true. So haven't we got a problem there?
Well, initially that can be distorted. Yeah, because there are always people, they'll buy into it regardless. Yes, you get that initially. But then over time, and surprisingly quickly, you see this is the whole concept of fad. So, oh, here's a new idea. Everybody latches onto it. But only things that have some persistency and truth will survive. And that should also be true about intellectual ideas as well.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Let me suggest perhaps a different way where people set up rival structures. This is still a free market approach, a libertarian approach. You have the free association of people,
yep.
But they're working from an alternative viewpoint. They yep. peer review each other's work and they create a dynamic. You know, we're setting up this new publishing group. They set up a dynamic with the establishment, you know, a kind of counterpoint to mainstream journals. And I think of the journal Biocomplexity, produced by the Biologic Institute, doing research into intelligent design. I mean, personally, this appeals to me. Do you think there's something to be said for this kind of approach?
Well, I think anywhere, we saw this in journalism, you know, where they went from being newspapers that were reporting news, and then they got into editorial opinion, and you had op-ed came into the lexicon. And then the better newspapers realized that if you had one op-ed opinion, then you should have the opposite op-ed on the other page. And the balance is always a good idea. So I would agree with that. But there's another issue here, Julian. In science, negative results are as important as positive results, but they never get published. And I remember a math professor at the university I taught at who was working on a doctoral thesis at Oxford, and he was working on a new theorem, and he hadn't seen his supervisor for a couple of years, and he developed a couple of directions for his new theorem. He went back to Oxford to see his supervisor. The supervisor looked at it and said, oh, well, Jones in 92 looked at that, and Smith in 36 looked at that. Those don't go anywhere. And he said to his supervisor, well, where's that published? He said, it isn't published. We don't publish negative results. So how much time is wasted going down blind alleys because you don't publish negative results? And that's another whole area that is eliminated by this only positive, only peer review, only what's acceptable. It's completely imbalanced.
I know we're getting towards the end of the interview, but I do want to come back to this radical free market view of things, because I'm yet to be completely convinced by it, because I'm just wondering if one leaves it to the marketplace in this radical way, whether there would be so much possibly damage done in that people would be reading and ingesting material which could be damaging to them, or false diets, false advice to do with medicine. Isn't there a case to be said that that kind of thing should be screened out, that kind of false information should be screened out by people who actually know what they're talking about?
But it's a much more narrow and potentially problematic system now. If you put out in the free market, then those experts, including the experts that now don't get to see this stuff or comment on it, would get to do it. So you expand the probability that something that's wrong will be picked up on. And of course, you see how gullible the academic world is.
Yeah, I just don't see how it would get picked up on in any really meaningful way. People would go and buy the kinds, because people do tend to self-select information. You know, they go and, this is confirmation bias, isn't it? They go and select the kind of books they want to read, and they build up a way of looking at the world, maybe completely false, and there's nothing there to check that. And this could go on from year after year after year before the marketplace can actually step in to correct that. And a lot of damage could be done in the process.
But that's happening now. And the damage is still happening. Mm. And by the way, your argument about seeking out material that confirms what you want to do, that is very human. I had a friend who had an old antique car, and another friend wanted to buy it. And of course, we seek out people that are going to agree with us. So he came to me and said, do you think I should buy this car? I said, no. He was very angry. And I said, Alan, if you don't like the answer, don't ask the question.
So would it be fair to say that you're saying this free market approach would be perhaps the best way to go. It wouldn't be a perfect way, but it would be better than what we've got now.
Exactly.
Although it looks nice and squeaky clean and controlled, what we have now, actually, in a hidden way, it's causing more damage than the alternative would be if we had it in a much more free, radically free way.
Exactly. As it is now, it is totally controlled. It's controlled by the people that put up the money for the research. It's controlled by the researchers that are trying to advance their career. It's controlled by the editors who want to get articles into their journals, and on and on and on. As I said, there's no such thing as a perfect system, but one that lets all of humanity with all of its warts and hang out there. And people can understand that. And one of the things, by the way, that is a deep fallacy of the whole environmental movement and the climate movement, they think that there's a no-risk world out there. There isn't. All you can do is try to reduce the risk, and that's what the way that we've got to approach the whole publication of information.
Well, as usual, you have given us a mass of really challenging things to think about. You know, whether we completely agree with all of your suggestions, in a sense, it doesn't matter. You've thrown out some really challenging things to dwell upon. And this is, I mean, this may not seem like a very important subject. It doesn't, directly affect many people's lives. And yet in an indirect way, of course, it does affect us, because there are all sorts of decisions made based upon peer review. So in this indirect, hidden way, it's affecting us all every day. And so it is very interesting to hear, and important to hear, an alternative view on this, and one which could perhaps open up many more conversations and many more alternatives and solutions to problems that are not being investigated at the moment. So I do thank you, Dr. Ball, for bringing this fresh perspective on this problem. And well, thank you again for coming on the show, and I very much look forward to our next conversation.
Well, thank you. And as I used to tell my students, I've poked your brain around, but the good news is that the brain has no nerve endings, so it won't hurt. But hopefully the ideas. Yeah. And that's all I hope to achieve, by the way, when people come up after and say, you really made me think. That's the objective.
Absolutely. Thank you ever so much.
Thanks, Julian.